The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Overuse of imaging in the initial staging and surveillance of cancer is presented by Dr. Amanda Lubenthal.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. And kind of as Dr. Hubbard said, this really was born out of that idea of Goldilocks medicine, not too much, not too little, and also in line with a lot of the Choosing Wisely campaigns that ASCO, the Thoracic Society, and also ASH has put out for some of these malignancies. So, objectives to cover in this talk include defining the issue of overuse as it relates to oncologic imaging, specifically for those four tumor types: breast, prostate, aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and specifically non-small cell lung cancer. Determine the target physician population for actually making changes, and reviewing evidence and expert opinion on guidelines. So a lot of this will bring up those guidelines. And in talking at the American College of Osteopathic Internists and also in conjunction with the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons, all of us in this room can be affected by these decisions. So whether you're the primary internist as the outpatient doctor, a hospitalist, pulmonologist, urologist, general surgeon, even for the nephrologist, we might spare some people some contrast. Medical oncologist, it impacts most of us in terms of how we take care of our patients. So I don't have any disclosures. And just a couple of questions to get us warmed up as to, you know, what to take away from this lecture. First one's pretty straightforward. Which type of medical imaging provides the highest dose of radiation for a single test? You have a CT of the chest, diagnostic PET CT scan, whole body bone scan, or a skeletal survey. And by far, it is the diagnostic PET CT scan. That can be over 20 millisieverts, which we'll get to actually in a later slide. I'm not going to read all these options to you, but question two is actually looking at patients being matched with appropriate imaging at the time of diagnosis. So if you can just take a minute and read through those four options and then identify in your mind which patient you would scan with that particular modality of imaging. I'll give you a minute. And I will say many of us are tempted to scan many of these patients with these types of imaging modalities. But if you look at the guidelines, there's only one clear, correct choice here. Sorry. And that's C. Our prostate cancer patient with a high PSA and a Gleason score of 7 with clinical T2 disease. Question 3 is actually looking at surveillance imaging. Again, it gives you the patient, their clinical scenario, and whether or not we should be scanning them and when. So if you look through these particular options, and again, I'll give you a minute to do so, I want you to identify in your mind who you would choose to scan in that scenario. Does everybody have a clear winner looking at this? Or are you thinking that you might be doing scans on a few of these patients? In accordance with guidelines, it's really the patient in A with an early stage breast cancer who should be getting mammogram and then routine office visits with physical exam. So why is overuse of imaging an issue? Well, there's cost, and that's huge, right? There's cost to the patient in terms of paying for their copay, the cost of taking time off work to go do it, and a lot of mental health cost because they get anxiety about the scan. They can get anxiety based upon the findings of the scan. That can lead to further testing or even further procedures if we're doing biopsies based upon it. And there are so many false positives, not to mention the cost to the insurance companies and to the entire kind of medical industry as a whole. In addition, we have to consider the radiation dose to these patients, and we don't talk about that very often. We also don't have a lot of good data as to their lifetime attributable risk after they have all of these repeat scans. So what drives the overutilization? In the article that they published in Critical Reviews in Oncology Hematology, a lot of it mentioned patient anxiety. I would argue fairly strongly that there's also probably some physician anxiety with these patients. And we don't have good prospective clinical trials looking at what we should do in these cases. We also don't have a very cohesive survivorship care plan. The American College of Surgeons put out guidelines saying that we should have these survivorship plans for patients that have completed their curative intent therapy. And sometimes we put these together, we might hand the patient a paper, we might have a visit simply about their survivorship plan, but we don't always do well coordinating with other clinicians involved in their care. So for instance, a breast cancer patient doesn't really need to be seeing their medical oncologist, their surgeon, their radiation oncologist every 3 months for 12 visits in a year. We really need to do a better job of figuring out how we're going to follow these people and who's going to be following them. The other thing really is that we always feel like we want to be doing something, because if we're doing scans, we must be changing the outcome. We must be actually taking care of that patient. When in fact, as we go through the evidence, that's probably not very true. So in talking about radiation risks, there's scant data. Unfortunately, we have a lot of data for single scans in a lifetime. We don't have very much at all in patients who've undergone multiple scans. So when we think about our oncology patients, we know that they've had multiple scans. I mean, Medicare made a rule that we could only do 3 PET scans in a lifetime as the patients on Medicare. So we know patients are getting multiple scans throughout their disease process. And depending on where you look, you can find slightly different numbers. But here was basically the breakdown between X-ray CT scans on the left and nuclear medicine tests on the right. And you can see chest X-ray, not a whole lot in the way of radiation exposure. The CT of the chest listed there is diagnostic with contrast, but if you actually look at like a low-dose screening CT scan, as in the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, that's closer to about 2 millisieverts. And you can see there, diagnostic CT with PET has the highest radiation exposure. So cancer risk from medical imaging has a lot to do with the age that you are at the time of exposure, and it also has to do with what organs are exposed. In particular, when we talk about PET CT scan, the injection that the patient gets of FDG goes out in the urine. So the bladder actually sees a much higher dose of that radiation than any other organ in the body, which predisposes then to potential bladder cancers down the line. And this table is actually a very, very helpful table. So the Archives of Internal Medicine back in 2009 published lifetime attributable risk for a single CT scan based upon what area was scanned. And it came up with percentages, they published percentages, but somebody actually went and made a table that made it a little bit more translational for us to communicate to our patients. So if you take a look at this chart, which you can actually find down at that link at Alium Cards, you can see that if you do a single head CT on a patient who's a 60-year-old male, you're probably not going to increase his risk all that much, right? It's about 1 in almost 15,000. But if you look down and you think about a CT of the chest in a female patient who's 20, her risk is 1 in 380. Again, that's one extra cancer diagnosed in 380 patients based upon doing that CT scan. And this is just one time, one snapshot in time. And I'm talking about an oncology patient population, but if you look down at coronary angiogram in a female at age 20, you can see that that's one in 150. So it's nothing to sneeze at. And again, we do multiple scans in these patients. The next three slides are going to talk about a study looking at Hong Kong patients and American patients in terms of their risk of developing a cancer as it relates to one PET scan. Now, the three slides will show you that as you increase the sensitivity and specificity of the scan, because it's a better image quality, you're actually also increasing the risk for the development of cancer. And as you see, the Hong Kong females actually have the highest risk, and that's because naturally they have a longer life expectancy than anybody else in the study. So they have more life years to develop a cancer as it relates to their PET CT exposure. So with the kind of grainiest image, I mean, still a PET scan image is a great image, but with the least sensitive and specific settings on the PET CT scanner, you can see that it's maybe 0.3% increased risk. Which again, let's say your risk for developing breast cancer is at 12%, and you move that from 12% to 12.3%, doesn't sound huge, but that's just one scan. When you kind of crank up the settings on your PET CT scanner, you start to see that lifetime attributable risk rise. Here, it's up to 0.5% in those female patients from Hong Kong. As the PET CT scanner gets even kind of more fine-tuned, that risk climbs above 0.6. And again, those are for the patients that are 20 at the time of exposure. As you get older, for those exposures, there are competing causes for death, so you don't necessarily see those same cancer cases diagnosed. So what's the cost of medical imaging? I mean, this should be fairly easy, right? We wish it looked like that needle in the haystack, but really it's actually like a real needle in a haystack. It's been driven because we want better image quality. So better image quality takes new technology. To develop new technology, it takes a lot of money. So, you know, people research it, they come up with the plan, then all of our hospitals have to go out and actually buy these imaging modalities and install them and maintain them. So in a little over 100 years, we went from having plain x-rays that were very rudimentary to having these very fancy PET CT scanners that can tell us a lot about a patient's cancer staging. So Ohio actually has a law that says that you have to publish your price list for the top imaging modalities that you use at your institution, which is why it's a little bit overrepresented on this slide. But you can see amongst different institutions or even different hospital branches within a system, costs are very, very different. If you're going to go to the Mayo Clinic, I would suggest you go to Arizona, not Florida. And I don't know why it's more expensive in Florida, but you can see a CT of the chest is going to run you about $400 more in Florida than it would in Arizona. We don't have a PET CT estimate for Ohio Health because it wasn't in their list of commonly utilized tests. But again, you can see there's a big difference there. CT of the chest at Ohio Health, $1,300. CT of the chest at University Hospitals Cleveland, $2,300. So if you took every new patient diagnosed with breast cancer each year and did a CT of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and a bone scan, that would run you about $730 million in terms of cost to the American healthcare system. And I'm not saying that I think it should be $500 million or it should be $900 million. It's just a lot of money to consider. So this is very similar to Dr. Hubbard's slide from earlier in that the top female, this is incidence, not death rates. These are incident rates. Female sites are on the left, male sites are on the right, and the ones that are starred are the ones that we're going to talk about. Not only because they're high yield and high incidence cancers, but also because we actually have guidelines about them and those Choosing Wisely campaigns. And the non-Hodgkin lymphoma listed here, it's taking into account all non-Hodgkin lymphoma, but we're going to be talking about the aggressive types. So what is the added value? And the other way I like to say this is, we spend a lot of money in medicine, and we're willing to spend a lot of money in medicine if it makes a difference. So breast cancer. What's the utility of bone scan in patients that are newly diagnosed with breast cancer? I find this pretty fascinating. In patients that were diagnosed with stage 1 or 2 breast cancer that are asymptomatic, meaning they don't have any bony complaints, there's no elevation in the alkaline phosphatase, it has a very low predictive value. So if you take an asymptomatic early stage breast cancer patient and you scan them, even if they have a positive bone scan, only 1 out of 9 of those patients will actually have a bone metastasis. It's not a good test to perform in that case. In surveillance, there was actually a study done by NSABP years ago looking at node-positive breast cancer patients and doing bone scans every 6 months for the first 3 years, followed by bone scan yearly, versus no bone scan at all. And they found that there was metastases identified in an asymptomatic patient only 0.6% of the time. This changed how they wrote trials. They didn't include this in trials anymore. And this is old news. This was back in like the 1980s. But we still see it get done. If we talk about CT and PET scan in stage 1 through 3 breast cancers at diagnosis, I'll break this down a little bit on the next slide, but it has a lot to do with staging and obviously symptoms in labs. And there's absolutely no benefit on mortality in surveillance using PET and CT scan. And actually, the Italian study over there that I highlighted, the X line is the cost of healthcare for oncology care. The gray line with the triangles is actually the increase in newer imaging, which they characterize as CT, MRI, and PET scan. And then the hashed line with the boxes, that's actually like X-ray ultrasound utilization. And you can see that those curves pretty closely mirror one another in terms of increased cost of care and increased utilization of these new imaging modalities. They put the caveat in there that there's probably some other things driving that cost up, but new imaging certainly does. So in stage 1 through 3 breast cancer at diagnosis, we really shouldn't be doing scans in an asymptomatic patient for stage 1 through 2B. In stage 3A, node-positive patients, we can consider doing a CT of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and you can consider doing a PET CT scan. If you're going to give preoperative systemic therapy, and it's not exactly clear, this is more of expert consensus, we should be doing some imaging at baseline before we give them chemotherapy or, in some cases, hormonal manipulation ahead of surgery. They also need to have an ultrasound of the axilla and biopsy of any abnormal-looking lymph nodes. So very quickly, you should be able to glance at these slides and see what we should and shouldn't do in terms of surveillance. Breast cancer surveillance should consist of mammogram yearly and history and physical with breast exam, axillary exam, 1 to 4 times per year. Obviously, in newer survivors, we see them more frequently, and then we space that out as time goes on. But you can see there's no role for tumor markers, no role for CT scans, no role for MRI or PET CT. And this is in line with ASCO's 2012 Choosing Wisely campaign. So basically telling us not to perform PET, CT, radionuclide bone scans in early breast cancer patients, and also that we shouldn't be doing these surveillance tests of either tumor markers or imaging in patients who've been treated with curative intent. Now, I do want to say, in delivering this lecture to the American College of Osteopathic Internists, one of the things that I would say that I see in my practice sometimes is I'll get a patient sent to me to reestablish for scans. And they might be 7 years out from diagnosis. And the patient comes in, and they want their scans. And it can be a very difficult discussion sometimes to talk to the patient about why that's not necessarily indicated at this point. I will also reiterate the fact that if they are symptomatic, all bets are off. These are for asymptomatic patients. So as we move into prostate cancer, and we talk about CT of the abdomen and pelvis, it has everything to do with their risk for lymph node metastasis. So the American Urological Association uses the guidelines of Gleason score greater than or equal to 8, PSA greater than 20, or clinical stage T3 or T4. If you use those guidelines, a large study through the University of Michigan showed that you would only miss a positive scan 0.5% of the time, but you could decrease utilization of these CT abdomen pelvis scans by 26%. The NCCN guidelines were a little bit less stringent, and I'll show you the comparison slide here in a second. But what I would say is let's at least pick something. I know the urologists are going to fall, you know, probably in line with the AUA guidelines. As a medical oncologist, a lot of the time I look to the NCCN guidelines. But many people are getting scans right now that don't necessarily need them. And we know that there's no role in doing these CT abdomen pelvis exams in patients who've been treated for cure. It does not impact overall survival. And that goes back to my whole thing about we're happy to do things, even when they're expensive, if they're going to impact care and cure. And just a note about active surveillance. In patients that we choose for active surveillance, there is no role for CT of the abdomen, pelvis, or bone scan. Those are the patients that we identify as low risk for progression, and they don't get any definitive treatment. We're just monitoring them carefully. So bone scan, very similar to what we talked about in terms of CT abdomen pelvis, the American Urologic Association guidelines, once again, were borne out in a University of Michigan study that showed if we use those guidelines listed there with a Gleason score, or I'm sorry, with a T2 PSA greater than 10, Gleason score greater than or equal to 8 and a PSA greater than 20, we were only going to miss a positive scan in less than 1% of patients. So we have good evidence that the guidelines that are out there work. Again, no change in overall survival in surveillance. So if you are interested in kind of determining the risk for lymph node metastasis, if you have a newly diagnosed patient, Memorial Sloan Kettering has a very nice nomogram. You just punch in all the clinical information, and it will kind of give you the percentage of risk. And I just put some up there that I had put in for a point of comparison so that you can see there's not a huge difference between a 50-year-old patient and a 70-year-old patient with the same clinical scores. But if you take a 70-year-old patient and increase the PSA, you can see how much that lymph node risk goes up from 1% to 10%. By NCCN, that would tell you that you need to do a CT of the abdomen pelvis. So you can see the different society guidelines here, NCCN, AUA, and the ASCO Choosing Wisely campaign looked at it from the negative standpoint. They said don't do it if it's less than or equal to a T2A. Don't do it if the Gleason score is less than or equal to 6. Don't do it if the PSA is less than 10. Bone scan, very similar. ASCO Choosing Wisely, once again, takes that don't do it if stance. And again, what should we be doing in patients that are treated for cure with their prostate cancer? We should be checking a PSA every 6 to 12 months for the first 5 years and then yearly thereafter. And they don't need a digital rectal exam if their PSA remains undetectable. We do not need to do CT scans, bone scans, or PET CT scans. Again, this is in line with the ASCO Choosing Wisely campaign that I put on the other two slides. So as we moved to non-small cell lung cancer, we thought maybe we had a little bit better data to tell us that we should be scanning these patients after treatment. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. As far as CT chest and abdomen goes, I mean, we diagnose lung cancer by CT of chest. So most of these patients are going to have had a CT of the chest before I ever meet them. We know that it's standard of care. Dr. Hubbard mentioned that. He talked about how important it was for us to look at the lymph nodes and, you know, to determine what next steps need to happen. But we also know that looking at mediastinal lymph nodes by size criteria alone is flawed. So we use PET CT scan in these patients as well. In terms of surveillance for non-small cell lung cancer, we don't have any good randomized prospective trials. There was a retrospective cohort study that said CT scan is probably better than X-ray. And we've extrapolated a lot from the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial of over 50,000 patients, where we saw that we could reduce the risk of cancer death by 3 cases per 1,000 from non-small cell lung cancer by doing yearly low-dose screening CT scans for 3 years. We've kind of extrapolated that data because we know that our patients with non-small cell lung cancer have about a 2% risk per year of developing a second lung cancer. In terms of PET CT scan, also standard of care at diagnosis in a patient with non-small cell lung cancer, especially because it's much better. You can see the numbers there in terms of sensitivity and specificity at looking at the mediastinum and also sort of upstaging patients and finding distant metastatic disease that we may have otherwise missed. Just another point, it's not necessarily about Goldilocks medicine, but if you get a patient that has some neurologic symptoms and you get a PET CT scan or they've had a PET CT scan that was essentially negative in the brain, please do the MRI. Because as one of my nuclear medicine attendings told me when I was in training, trying to find a brain metastasis on a PET scan is like trying to see a candle sitting next to the sun. You're trying to find the bright spot in the bright spot. So please do an MRI of the brain in that case. And there's no role for a bone scan if a PET scan's already been done. They're looking at the bones, both of them. In terms of PET scan and follow-up for patients who've been curatively treated for their lung cancer, there's no impact on overall survival. So by now, you're probably getting bored with this theme, that there's no impact on overall survival for following these patients with scans. And that's really the thrust of the lecture. We do use PET scan, though, in those patients that have an abnormality on CT scan, and we don't quite know what to do with it. Do they need to go for bronchoscopy or EBUS or biopsy? Or is this something that we can follow on a scan down the line? There are some instances where it can be difficult to interpret a PET scan, especially if a patient's had radiation. There can sometimes be abnormalities for up to 2 years after the completion of radiation. And then in terms of brain MRI for a patient with non-small cell lung cancer, we always used to recommend it in anybody above stage 2. There was actually a study that showed that we should probably be considering it in somebody that's stage 1B as well. In a small study that was only ever reported in abstract form, about 200 patients, they showed that patients with stage 1A disease had brain metastasis that were asymptomatic only 2% of the time. So it wasn't a huge bang for your buck. But if you took a patient that was above that and did a brain MRI, you found asymptomatic brain metastases in almost 8% of patients. So it seemed prudent to do that in those patients. Interestingly, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons has recommended, of course, against doing a brain MRI in an asymptomatic patient who's stage 1. They actually put that out in their Choosing Wisely campaign, and then they went back and did sort of a retrospective review to figure out what's actually happening in patients now that they've put out this guideline. And they showed that 12% of patients were still getting a brain MRI when it wasn't really felt to be indicated. And again, in surveillance, there's absolutely no data whatsoever to say that it improves overall survival. So if you look for imaging at diagnosis in lung cancer, CT scan, PET CT scan, and brain MRI, definitely stage 2 or above, and consider in stage 1B. If anybody's symptomatic, get the brain MRI. So surveillance and treated lung cancer, NCCN and the American College of Chest Physicians, their guidelines are a little bit different. But in general, kind of looking at doing a CT scan every 6 months for up to about 2 years, and then yearly thereafter. And again, I said a lot of that came from extrapolation from the lung cancer screening trial. We know that doing tumor markers, MRI, and PET CT scan does not change the outcome, and we should not be doing those things. But how much do we really know? So there was actually a study presented at ESMO, the European Society of Medical Oncology, in August, and it showed us a study of patient population of about 1,800 patients, stage 1 through 3, who were randomized to either HMP with chest X-ray or HMP with chest CT or thoracoabdominal CT, as well as bronchoscopy every 6 months for 2 years and then yearly up to year 5. And what they found is that there's actually at this point no difference in overall survival in those patients at 8+ years out. Now, when I looked at the numbers, I would think that 99 months and 123 months would be statistically significant, but it wasn't. And if you look at the 8-year overall survival rates, 51% to 54%, that also was not statistically significant. They hypothesized that if they continue to follow that out a little bit longer, they might start to see something. But at this point, there's still no data that following these patients with CT scan changes overall survival. So again, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Choosing Wisely campaign, we talked about brain MRI and stage one lung cancers. And the big concern with this is that there's about 11% false positive rate. And in the patients who have a false positive MRI, it delays treatment for the actual known cancer in their chest. When we talk about aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma, this is actually sort of what got me interested in this topic a few years ago. We know that using PET CT scan is truly part of the diagnostic workup and staging of these patients, so everybody should get it. It's standard of care to have this at the time of diagnosis. And we use it in interval restaging to make sure that they responded to treatment. But in terms of surveillance, when this study was published back in 2014, it kind of made me stop, because they showed about 700 patients in the US and France that were treated for their aggressive diffuse large B-cell lymphomas with an anthracycline-based therapy, which is standard of care treatment. And what they saw was that only 1.6% of patients were found to have asymptomatic relapse of disease. By far, those patients that were diagnosed with relapse disease presented with signs or symptoms of relapse. And yet, we're exposing those patients to increased doses of radiation. And we know that they've probably had at least 2 PET scans as a result of their diagnosis and response to treatment. So they've already had pretty high doses of radiation in terms of imaging modalities. So do we really want to subject them to ongoing CT scans or PET CT scans if 98% of the time they're gonna present with those signs and symptoms? And when we talk about relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and I don't mean to be crass at all about this, but if I detect it at 1 month versus the next month, you know, on an asymptomatic patient on a scan versus they come in with some symptom a month later, the treatment doesn't vary that much. The treatment for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma relapse is really giving additional chemotherapy and usually following to stem cell transplant if they're eligible for that. So again, I'm not taking away that we always want to find ways to do early diagnosis, but in terms of early relapse, it doesn't necessarily change outcome in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So in terms of surveillance, stage one or two disease, we really shouldn't be doing a whole lot of scans. We should be seeing those patients, talking to them, examining them, lymphadenopathy, splenomegaly, those types of things. But scans really aren't a part of it. We just want to confirm, at least with one set of scans, after treatment that they are in complete remission. As far as stage 3 to 4 disease, we're really looking at potentially doing scans no more often than every 6 months for up to the first 2 years or so. No PET CT. PET CT has not been shown to improve overall survival in these patients. And this is also in line with American Society of Hematology's Choosing Wisely campaign, where we should really limit how much we use CT scans in patients treated for aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So in summary, oncologic imaging is expensive, and it's time, money, anxiety, and the radiation risk that we still really can't quantify. And the issue is, it takes a lot of time to educate patients as to what the appropriate next step should be. They and we sometimes feel like we're doing more if we do scans. And honestly, the way that I try to do it in my practice, if I have a patient that's really anxious about this but has no other indication to have a scan done, I will pull up the guidelines in the exam room, I'll print off that slide, I will kind of circle their pathway on it, and let them take it home. Because I think we all worry about what happens if we miss that 0.5%, or what happens if we miss that patient. And we all have that worry. But we also, I mean, that's through all aspects of medicine. It's the same thing with following that solitary pulmonary nodule or following that patient with Barrett's esophagus. We know that the odds are in favor of us following guidelines and finding things based upon what has been published in terms of natural history. So we all play a role in this, and I would just encourage you to really think about how we can help to minimize scans in patients where there's really no indication, so that we can hopefully minimize their potential radiation toxicity and also cost to our medical system as a whole. And this is something I'm not so good at either, and I'm working to be better at it. but coordinating care with other medical specialists is really paramount at this point. As I said, I gave the example of the patient with early stage breast cancer who she comes to see me and I realize she's already had 9 visits that year in follow-up of her early stage breast cancer. That doesn't need to happen. And there's no clear guideline as to who should be following these patients. So we all sort of take ownership of it because we don't want a patient to slip through the cracks. But I don't need to, I mean, especially if the patient's not on any sort of adjuvant treatment from my standpoint, it doesn't have to be me if the breast surgeon wanted to follow that patient or if their, you know, radiation doctor wanted to follow that patient. I tend to take that on, right or wrong, but I think we all just need to have honest conversations with one another. And remembering that scans do not equal active survivorship. So discussing it, like I said, and this cannot be stated enough, surveillance guidelines were made for asymptomatic patients. I have a very low threshold for actually doing scans in a patient who has some sort of complaint. And I usually, when we're talking about survivorship in the office, you know, they say, what do I need to look for? And I'll say, you know what, if you go out and you're digging up weeds in your garden and you're sore 2 days later for 3 days or so, I said, you don't need to call me about that. If you walk out of your house and you twist your ankle and it's hurting for 2 weeks, probably don't need to call for that if there's a mechanism for that injury. I mean, you can go be seen, but it's probably not an oncologic issue. But if all of a sudden, out of really nowhere, you're starting to have dizziness or lightheadedness, or your gait is becoming impaired, or you have nagging bone pain in your back that you never had before, I have a very low threshold for doing imaging. And I tell those patients, when we set up the follow-up in 3 months or 4 months, that doesn't mean that if something comes up in between that you shouldn't call me. Those are very arbitrary numbers for when I'm going to see you back. And I think that gives them some sort of healthy idea of when they should notify us and when they don't have to worry. So if you were at all interested in any of the cost estimates for scans, the Mayo Clinic has a very nice cost estimator available. And if you liked that chart that had the 1 in 300 or the 1 in 14,000, you can find that at the second website listed there. And then just as an informational thing, I would definitely suggest that everybody have a membership in the National Comprehensive Cancer Network website. It's free, you have to make a login, and you can go in and actually see staging scans that should be done. You can look at treatment option algorithms, and for each disease process on which they have a guideline, there's a very nice summary at the end of each guideline that goes through the most important parts of treatment with the clinical trials laid out. It's very, very concise and very informative. And it's really good for any practice at all, because if you're a family, or if you're an internist in the community, or if you're a hospitalist, maybe you don't know the doctors that you're referring to very well. This is actually a way that you can go in and you can start to build an understanding for how they're practicing because you see what should be done. As far as from a medical oncology perspective, I use the NCCN guidelines all the time. So it is a very, very easy way to have concise information at your fingertips. And we'll have questions at the panel discussion. Thank you.
I'd like to invite Dr. Simpson back to the platform, and we will be happy to take your questions. We only have one microphone in the room, and it's on this aisle here, so please step to the microphone so everyone can hear your question. Really? We put 2,000 people to sleep in less than 2 hours? We're anesthesiologists. What do you know? Any questions? Okay, somebody's coming to the microphone. You don't have to run, doctor. Take your time.
So you showed the slide with the cost of the PET scans and CT scans. What is the cost of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and a bone scan compared to a PET scan? You didn't have bone scan on there.
You know what? Can you hear me?
No.
I don't have that off the top of my head. I mean, I would have to go back and look at the slide, but you can't even really find a good cost estimate for what a CT of the chest costs overall. You can only come up with specific examples from certain hospitals. So I don't have a good answer for you there.
My question always to the insurance company when I'm fighting for a PET scan is invariably I get the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and bone scan because that's what they require, and then there's something that's inconclusive and the patient still gets a PET scan. So yeah. We have way more radiation and way more cost.
Absolutely, it's more radiation exposure, and I think it's the way the guidelines are written. The evidence is not as strong for PET CT scan, so they put it in as an optional category on NCCN, and a lot of the insurance companies follow that very carefully.
In your discussion, I noticed you didn't include renal cell carcinoma surveillance. Could you just briefly touch on that?
I didn't include that one because it wasn't included in the Choosing Wisely campaign. I couldn't cite all of the data for you on that, but essentially it is CT usually at least every 6 months for the first 2 years.
Any comments on the recurrence? I've had a very unusual year where I've had a couple of my patients that have had renal cell that 16 years later have recurrence in the bed, and you know their surveillance was appropriate up to 5 years, and then we didn't do any surveillance.
Anna, we know that renal cell, melanoma, hormone-positive breast cancer, those types of tumors have a long potential risk for recurrence, a small percentage of them. In hormone-positive breast cancer, it can be up to 20 to 25%. So unfortunately, I think it's one of those numbers things where we're going to catch most patients if we follow them through 5 years. And I'll ask Dr. Hubbard if he has any additional input on that.
Well, thanks. Yeah, part of the challenge is in those patients who have a long natural history, you're also essentially saying that there's a long potential for exposure to ionizing radiation because you're going to have to follow those people for extended periods of time. In hormone receptor positive breast cancer, half of the recurrences occur in the second decade of the disease. And so consequently, trying to strategize and come up with a plan to follow those people over the long term. Dr. Lubenthal used a term that I think was very appropriate, and that is survivorship. How do we manage the survivors? There's somewhere between 14 and 16 million of them now. Within the next 5 years, there's going to be closer to 19 million survivors as we understand how to manage them. And so I don't know that we've necessarily got any answers in October of 2017, but I will say that this is a topic of intense interest for every physician who manages cancer for whom long survivability. So internists, surgeons, subspecialists, family physicians, other primary care physicians are going to need to be thoughtful, and we're going to all need to be at the table as we go forward and have those discussions, but they're very timely.
Well, good afternoon, thank you for the talk. I have a young lady in my practice that I inherited from another state, and she's somewhat in a panic because she's 25 years old and she has the HER2 and BRCA mutation. And where she had come from was they were advocating repetitive MRI of breast, and I'm not sure if that's something that should be continued or not. What are your thoughts on the repetitive MRIs for possible breast disease that doesn't exist yet?
In terms of, this is a patient that has a BRCA mutation, then yes, I would be in favor of continuing to follow with MRI of the breast if she's opting to not undergo any sort of mastectomy, prophylactic mastectomy at this time.
Especially for patients who are younger than 30, we say the breasts are radiosensitive to mammography, and so in that instance, we would advocate for the use of MRI. Sometimes in those high-risk patients, we advocate for both annual MRI and mammogram, and sometimes those are done at the same time. What I like to do is 6 months, get a mammogram, 6 months later, get an MRI, and do a clinical breast exam at both of those visits so the patients are being followed a bit more closely. And so if you are advocating for eventual prophylactic mastectomy, if that's something she chooses, you can wait until after childbearing. We know that for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, BRCA1, the risk rises sharply after 35, and BRCA2 after 45. And so those are kind of some indications and guidelines you can give patients if they are leaning towards that. When would be an appropriate time for that?
Hi, thank you for your presentations. My question is about, changing the culture around getting these repetitive scans. As you said, that even though the research has shown that there's little benefit to them, in retrospect, we do it anyway. So can you talk a little bit about the steps, maybe, of how to kind of maybe change the culture around that? I know also patients are asking for the scans too, so how do we kind of deal with all that? Thanks.
Well, I think part of it is, you know, having sessions like this. When we sat down last year and we were trying to come up with topics for discussion this year, this was one of them for that reason, because if we don't talk about it, we're not going to change our practice. And it's really no different than when kind of, you know, PSA, and should we be doing PSA on every, you know, every male patient year after year? It comes down to really discussion and communication with the patient, which takes more time than just checking to order the CT chest, abdomen, pelvis. But it is important. And I've found that when I take the time, in the majority of patients, when I take the time and show them guidelines, talk about these percentages with them, most of the time they will kind of agree with that. But if I just kind of brush off their concerns and fears and say, I'm not ordering a scan, obviously that's not strengthening our physician-patient relationship in any way. So it just takes time. And like I said, I will pull up the guidelines in the room, print them off, and talk to the patient about them. I don't know if anybody...
Thanks. I think your phrase about changing the culture is very appropriate, because it's the physician body, it's all of us together, but it's also helping the general public understand what care looks like. In the previous generation, you know, when I was training in the late 80s and early 90s, you did these scans. Number one, you had a lack of information about whether or not they were all that helpful, and number two, about the dose of radiation and its potential harmful effects at that point. We did it because it came out of the clinical trials that we were doing at the time, and so we just automatically presumed that if this is what you did when you followed patients in the context of a clinical trial, this is what you did for your general patient population, and everybody got scans. And it became a culture of caring. We care about you, and we don't want to miss anything, so we want you to come in so that we make sure we get proper surveillance. And so there's a culture out there now that thinks that for oncologists to care for patients, you do scans. That's what care looks like. That's what it means when we say we care about you, we wanted to do a good job caring for you. Now we've got information that shows that caring, in a very real sense, has been harmful to a certain extent. Now we've got to pull back from that a little bit, and we've got the evidence that demonstrates that we can do good, but we have potential to do harm if we're not careful. So it's what care looks like. We've also had trouble getting uniform adherence to this within our own specialty groups. And so people go to their places where they're active. Women go to the beauty shop, men go to the barber shop, and they hear, well, my doctor's doing this, that, and the other. What's your doctor doing? Oh, really not so much. I'm not doing any of those things. Really? Well, I wonder how much your doctor really cares then. That's the take-home message. And so they come home from the beauty shop and the barber shop, and they think their doctor doesn't give a rip because they're not ordering all those scans that the other doctor across town is. So it's changing the mindset that caring means that we use our tools wisely and that we use them with ultimate concern and with a strong appreciation for the potential harm that we can do if we're not really cautious and really thoughtful about what we're doing. And Amanda, you're absolutely right. It takes time to have that conversation, but it's a conversation worth having.
So I have a two-part question. One is, does the radiation exposure increase the risk of solid versus liquid tumors more? And is there been any surveillance for the exposure of patients who have already been exposed for multiple scans? Has it been devised in the future to surveillance?
It was difficult for me to find any real data looking at patients who've had multiple scans. The numbers that I presented were for just single lifetime scans. In terms of solid or liquid tumors, they both can occur. I don't have a percentage breakdown for you of solid versus liquid, but certainly myelodysplastic syndrome is something that we see with radiation exposure, as well as certainly like sarcomas and things like that. So.
Hi, David Covey from Searcy, Arkansas. This question is really just a little bit tangential, but it plays off Dr. Hubbard's
comments. We can't quite hear you very well.
Okay. David Covey from Searcy, Arkansas. It's, the question's a bit tangential, but plays off of Dr. Hubbard's concept of the psychology of radiation risk exposure. I think in general, patients who've had cancer much more fear the cancer than they do any risk of carcinogenesis from further radiation. Therefore, they're going to be subject to the physician who orders excessive tests and the feeling that they're getting the best in care no matter how many excessive tests they get. But what we've seen in our hospital is patients who are drug-seeking, and it plays into the opioid epidemic, is that we found a patient the other day who had come in with complaints of abdominal pain, chest pain, various pains, and had probably 35 CAT scans. You know, this is happening all over the country. I suspect we're not unique in that situation. And no one yet is really tracking that. There's no system. We don't do like France and have everybody put their medical records on a little credit card-sized chip. And so I really wonder, is there any will for following this in patients and what the risks really will be in the future?
I mean, I think that there should be. Certainly, a lot of these patients that we're seeing in the opioid crisis are young, and so their life years ahead of them for the development of future cancers are much higher than our, 50, 60, 70-year-old patients. So, yes, I agree with you. I don't know of anybody that's actually doing any study or any sort of implementation of radiation, diagnostic radiation tracking. I don't know if anybody else knows of any, but I've not seen anything.
Yeah.
Great idea.